What is peace brain? Peace brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics, open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth, and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Hello, this is Dr. Gail Lash, and welcome to the Peace Brain Show. I'm happy that you tuned in to us today. And today we have an amazing guest, Masoud Alafani. Sorry, Masoud, that okay. With us. He is a renowned artist, a sculpturist, an actor, just an all-around Renaissance artist. And we're going to be talking about the powerful topic of peace through art, and a show that he is doing. He actually has on exhibition at MoCA, Georgia, as we speak. And so we hope that if you're in the Atlanta area, that you can come by and see this exhibition. It is really fabulous. So, as always, though, two things. Stay tuned for the end of the show. We have a transformative meditation that we always do at the end of the show, and I hope you will participate in that. And as always, I open the show with a quote. And this quote today is about art from a religious leader and a humanitarian named Abdu'l-Bahá. And it goes like this. I rejoice to hear that thou takest pains with thine art, for in this wonderful new age, art is worship. The more thou strives to perfect it, the closer wilt thou come to God. What bestowal could be greater than this, that one's art should be even as the art of worshiping the Lord? That is to say, when thy fingers grasp the paintbrush, it is as if thou wert at prayer in the temple. Wow. I love this quote because it points out, in fact, I got shivers just reading it. It points out how art really uplifts the soul and is the same as worshiping God. And we know that art is something that inspires all of us. It opens our hearts. It opens the possibilities to new meanings, new interpretations of what may just be a daily ritual or a daily action that we don't give it a thought. But when it is placed in the arts, whether it be drama or voice, singing, poetry, or sculpture or painting, we find that new meanings can be heard, can be seen, can be felt. And so art is so important for the human soul and for human society. And I know that these days art requires persistence and funding and for humanity, for you, the listeners, to say, yes, we need art. We need that. And it really does bring a whole new dimension to our lives and our lifestyle. I know that in the schools, they've added art as one of the prerequisites or one of the core curriculum, which is really beautiful to add to the science and math, because we have this left brain part of ourselves and right brain part of ourselves that need to be balanced, not just one-sided. So today we have Masoud Alafani, and he is an amazing artist and an amazing man who has persevered with his passions for many, many years. And it really, Masoud's art is very deep. But if you can see this art, to do so. So let me read his bio, and it's a little long. But that's because of all of his accomplishments. So, Masoud Ashley Alafani is an Atlanta-based mixed-media artist whose studio practice is rooted in the discipline of sculpture. He is a graduate of Arts High School in Newark, New Jersey, Morehouse College, and the Savannah College of Art and Design, where he earned his MFA in sculpture in 2012. Masood has exhibited his work in group and solo shows in Atlanta, Georgia, New Orleans, Louisiana, Chicago, Illinois, Richmond, Virginia, Lacoste, France, and Hong Kong, China. The artist has completed residencies in Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia, in the Vermont Studio Center, the Hambridge Center for the Arts and Sciences in Rayburn, Georgia, Creative Currents in Portobello, Panama, and the Creatives Project in Atlanta, Georgia. He is a recipient of the 2015-16 MoCA Georgia Working Artist Project Grant and a 2015 IDEA Capital Grant and the 2015 Southwest Airlines Art and Social Engagement Grant, and is a 2014 and 15 Walt Hall Fellow. In the summer of 2016, he is a resident of the Atlanta Contemporary Art Center. And his statement, I love this statement, so I wanted to read it. And all of this is on Masood's website, which is Masood, Masood-Olufani, Olufani, .squarespace.com. So here is his artist statement. He says, "My objects aspire to be visual poems, works of art that reach beyond themselves to reveal something meaningful about the human experience. I attempt to create work which blends formal elegance, emotional integrity, and spiritual resonance. At the core of my creative impulses lies a principle which is diametrically opposed to the cynicism and doubt that seems to shape and define the present worldview: hope. I still believe in the transformative potential of art, that in spite of the undertow of our overly materialistic society, the power of artistic expression rests in its ability to lift the spirit and inspire new ways of seeing. It is this faith in the inherent potentialities latent within the vision of the artist that compels me to create. I work with one eye towards the world and the other towards the beyond. Through the juxtaposition of disparate materials that resonate with historical, sociological, and psychological meanings, I critique our collective past and present, and point a finger towards a more hopeful future. My devotion to craft and the slow, methodical realization of an idea reflects my belief in the dignity of labor and that the maker imbues the object with spirit through disciplined physical exertion, fueled by vision and creativity. I am a Baha'i, and my work as an artist is directed towards the realization of the oneness of the human family. I see myself as an instrument in the hand of the Creator, used to carry forward an ever-advancing civilization." Wow, Masood, what a statement. Welcome to the Peace Brain Show today. I am so happy to have you here.
Well, I'm honored to be here. Thank you, Gail.
Tell us a bit about that statement. I mean, it says it all, but wow, what an inspiration.
Artist statements are always hard because you're trying to communicate basically what the frame of your creative impulse is. And so you're trying to do that in a concise manner so that it doesn't go on and on and on and on. And I was just trying to be honest about what I felt like the genesis, the foundational elements of why I make what I make, and what the motivation is. And at the core of my practice is really a belief in the power of art to be a transformative instrument for carrying forward an ever-advancing civilization, which, of course, as a Baha'i, is a very important element of the Baha'i faith. So I'm just always looking for honesty and trying to, in everything that I do, in particular in terms of my creative practice, because I think the power of the work People can tell when you're being truthful in the work, and they also can tell when you're painting with a false brush. So I try to be as honest as I can.
Yes, yes. So what drew you to become a professional artist? Your work is so deep, and it's so involved with so many creative parts of yourself. I assume that had something to do with it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been drawing since I was four. And I was fortunate. I had a mother who was not afraid of her child becoming an artist. My mother, who made her transition in 2007, was a writer, although unpublished, but she loved to write. She was a voracious reader. And she always took me to the theater, to the museums. And very early on, when she saw that I liked to draw, she started bringing me paper and pencils home from work, from the office that she worked at, and encouraging me to continue drawing. And I remember very early on, she got me a book on Michelangelo. And I could barely carry the book. I was so small, I could barely hold up the book. But it opened up a world for me. And it just encouraged me to continue doing what I was doing and developing slowly my gifts and my talents. And I just went from there. There's no one in my family other than myself who's a practicing artist. I mean, I really am the first in terms of a professional experience. So I didn't really have anybody to point to for an example. So I kind of had to find my way. And fortunately, I met some really wonderful people from a variety of different backgrounds and walks of life who in many ways were my angels along the way. And helped to guide me and encourage me, even at moments when I was a bit discouraged. They would lift me up and tell me, you got to keep going, you have a gift. And thank God for those people, because it would have been much more difficult, even more than it was. And it was a difficult journey, but it would have been much more difficult had I not had those people in my life. So I'm very, very fortunate to have had some of the friendships that I've had along the way to help encourage me. Yeah.
And we all need mentors along the way, and that as inspiration. Have you considered being, or maybe you already have, being a mentor to other young artists?
Yeah, you know, I'm always, it's funny because, service is something that I had to grow into, the idea of service. I didn't really grow up with an active passion for service. I was, just kind of involved in my own thing. But as I got a bit more mature and a bit more spiritually grounded, and certainly my faith is instrumental in helping me understand the importance of service, I'm always actively looking for opportunities to mentor and encourage young people. And I've been fortunate. I haven't, was assigned a apprentice as part of the Working Artist Project grant through local GA, a really fantastic photographer named Davion Alston. And in a way, I really was, I think, able to, help him realize some things for himself as he helped me realize some things for myself. And that's the thing about mentorship. It really is not a one-way street. It really is a kind of give and take. And they bring to you some things that, we think that we're giving whoever that mentee is, what they need. But in reality, we find that we are also getting some of what we need. So it really is.
That is very true.
Yeah, and that's the way service is. So it's you're getting back just as much as you put out, if not more than what you put out. So, yeah.
That's true, absolutely. So I'm glad you mentioned David and the photography, because the advertisement for this solo exhibition that you have at MoCA GA at MoCA Georgia here in Atlanta, which goes on through September 10th for all of you listeners. It's called The Poetics of the Disembodied. And the advertisement for it are these amazing pictures of you out in nature that David took. And you're wearing this amazing jacket of it's a patchwork, and you have this bright blue paint, I guess, on your face and your hands. And could you tell us something about those photographs and why those elements in it?
Yeah, sure. I was doing a residency at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, which was an amazing experience. And, of course, I was in Savannah. You're close to the Georgia Sea Islands, but I've always wanted to go to Sapelo Island and Asaba Island, and I was able to coordinate a trip through SCAD, Savannah, and Savannah College of Art and Design organized everything, leased a boat, and we were able to go over to the island. And I had always thought that I was going to take some photographs and video of the experience, not exactly knowing how I was going to use it as I worked my way up towards the show, the exhibition date. But as we went to Asaba Island in particular, and they have three really wonderfully preserved and restored slave cabins made out of tabby, which is a mixture of seashell and lime, which was based on the technology that West Africans brought to America during slavery. We started photographing, Davion and I did, started photographing in those spaces. We got permission to do so. And it became quite clear to me that I wanted to advertise or promote the show kind of with a bit of mystery. I didn't want to reveal to the audience exactly what they were going to get in terms of actual physical work itself. So I wanted to create a kind of spiritual resonance, a kind of mystery that would get people intrigued and looking forward to the exhibition. So we came up with this idea. I started thinking about the color blue because Haint blue is a color that is very prevalent among in the houses of slaves in Savannah and coastal Georgia, and I'm sure other parts of the Deep South. They would paint the inside of their houses this color called Haint blue, which is H-A-I-N-T, Haint, to ward off evil spirits. So you would find the walls of slave cabins painted this really beautiful blue. And amongst the Gullah Geechee people on the Georgia Sea Islands, Sapelo, and some of the other islands, they view the color blue as a good spirit. So I immediately knew blue as a primary color would be a really a wonderful color to kind of have as part of the photo session. And it was a ritual. And then the jacket came from kind of like a festive or a ritualized costume in a way, with all these tiny bags made of cloth and with Georgia red clay in the bags. And then the eyes of Robert Johnson, the great jazz guitarist, kind of peering out, looking out into the world almost as a third eye sort of thing. So there was a ritualized aspect to the sessions and then the choice of garments and also color of skin. And then one last thing I would say is that that color blue is also associated with Nimeya, who is one of the Yoruba goddesses, the goddess of water. And you will find amongst the Yoruba practitioners of Ife in Brazil and some other parts of the country, they dress themselves up in white for their rituals, and you will see renditions of the goddess in blue. I mean, she's blue, like the color of the sea. So she's always associated with water, with rivers and the ocean. So it was all of those things kind of layering, kind of operating multivalently, and really hoping to create a kind of atmospheric, spiritually resonant experience that got people intrigued and interested in coming to the exhibition.
Wow, thank you. Lots of detail there and lots of overlapping spiritual principles and practices. I love it. So I'd like to talk about your solo exhibition, The Poetics of the Disembodied. Tell us a little bit about the title and the overview of this, of all these pieces. I believe you have 17 pieces, some big, some small. Well, actually, they're all big. But at this MoCA Georgia exhibition, and then we'll talk about some specifically about some of these exhibits. But why Poetics of the Disembodied?
Yeah, you know, so the title Poetics of the Disembodied is associated with Jack Kerouac. But when I selected it, I wasn't thinking Jack Kerouac at all. I was thinking about, which is interesting, you hear things. This is the other part of the art-making process that I've learned. Sometimes you hear things in passing or you come across things in passing and you don't know how they're going to resonate for you down the road. But they find their way into your memory cortex, into your DNA in a way. And then at the right appropriate moment, they come out and you accept it. So I was thinking when I came to the title Poetics of the Disembodied, I was thinking the stories of the ancestors of those that have gone on, those who are not present physically, but their stories resonate the kind of poetic elegance through the generations, through the years. So that's what I was thinking when the title came to me. But, of course, at some iteration, I had heard it before in association with Jack Kerouac and the Beat Poets. But that's not what I was thinking when I used the title. So, yeah.
So let's talk about one of your pieces. It's very interesting when you see it. When I saw the exhibition, it is simply a charcoal drawing on wood with a steel chain attached to it and an animal trap in the dirt. And I know there's a complex meanings behind all of your art. This one is titled A Snare for Ezekiel Charles. Tell us a little bit more about that particular piece, please.
Well, that was a really really powerful example of trusting the muse or trusting the spirit. Because I was actually at my favorite place for purchasing wood in the city, a place called Carlton Woods, where they have all these exotic woods from around the world. And so I was in there, and I was in the basement fingering through some different woods and saw this incredible piece carved out just the way that it is in the exhibition. So it was cut, like sliced right through from a tree. And, you know, that layer was bare just as it was. And I kept coming back to it. So I would walk through the shop, and then it was sitting like that. Then I actually left the shop, and then I drove back to come back and get it.
So, it called to you.
Yes, it did. And I didn't know exactly how I was going to use it, but when I brought it back to the studio, I immediately thought a drawing on the surface itself. And I did a simple chart drawing of this this man in profile, African-American male. And then I had this old chain in the studio, and I embedded it in the bottom because the trunk seemed to fit that. They seemed to work together really well. And then the whole idea of a trapping device, of a snaring device. And for me, it's a made-up narrative. Ezekiel Charles, I have no idea who Ezekiel Charles is. The name is biblical, of course. But Ezekiel Charles, to me, could be anybody. And I'm always interested in my work is presenting a scenario, a situation, a set number of materials that work together in a particular way and suggesting a possible meaning and then allowing the viewer to come up with their own interpretation. So I try to get really close up to the point of really telling you what I'm thinking, but then I try to pull back from that place. So I want you to get a suggestion of what I might be thinking, but then I want you, based on your own experience, to complete the narrative. So the snare could be anything. What are the snares? What are the possible snares for Ezekiel Charles or any one of us? Obviously, this is an African-American male, so people, the easiest read is racism, and that's a very legitimate snare. Could it also be crime? That's a very legitimate snare. Could it be lack of educational opportunities? A very legitimate snare. What are the multitude of snares that could trap us? And I was really interested in the tension of that device being open, and I'm talking about the animal trap itself, mm-hmm. and how there's something really foreboding about that and kind of dangerous. And the potential.
Yes, there was. I didn't want to step near it because I was afraid I might get caught.
Right. And it's all welded, so it's not going to go anywhere. So, but just the idea in the viewer's mind, the potential for danger, to me was something that I was really interested in communicating. And So I think from my point of view, that those are the types of things I was thinking about when I came up with those associations in creating that piece.
Mm. And we are all snared by various things in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
That many times it takes, I was going to say it takes years to release. That is not always the case. It can take moments to release if we choose. But we all have things we're working on to not get snared by or not get held back by and to work around, create solutions for. Yeah, very powerful piece, Masood. I really enjoyed that one.
Thank you.
And as all of your pieces are, so let's go down the line. Well, I don't want to go down the line, but there are some that I definitely want to talk about. One is in your grand opening last week, you actually have a piece called Blocked. And for your listeners, it has a wooden block on the floor, just about a foot square or maybe a little bigger, a cubic foot. And then there's a screen behind showing pictures or showing a video of the MARTA station, which is the Metro Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority's train station that gets people around the city. And the main station is called Five Points. And you have a film of people coming and going at Five Points, the train station. But behind that, superimposed on that, you have the slave trade, the slave market, where people were sold. And evidently, and you, I definitely want you to talk about this, this was also the actual location of where slaves were sold back in the 1800s. And it was so powerful when you had a woman, black African woman, come and stand on that slave block and sing. And I believe, although we were all kind of weeping, I believe she was saying she wanted to let go of her fear because she was being sold. And the whole room was transformed into grief. So very powerful piece. Please talk to us a bit about that.
Well, in the other iteration of my professional practice, I'm also an actor, and I've been fortunate enough to work on some really amazing projects. And one of those projects was something called 37 Weeks Sherman on the March, which basically tracks the journey of General Sherman across Georgia during the Civil War. And I was involved in a documentary film project with that, and they had the premiere at the Atlanta History Center, and I was fortunate enough to go. And at the end of the film, they showed scenes of Atlanta during the 1800s, and then they would morph up and show the same scene today. And they showed this slave auction house, which is the Crawford slave auction house in Crawford Long. And then they showed Five Points MARTA station. Well, I was actually absolutely blown away because there's no public indicator at that space that area was used for another purpose in its former iteration. So I was absolutely blown away and a bit angered because it seemed to me to be a conscious way of controlling the collective memory, and I wanted to do something to kind of correct the record. So I am proposing a permanent work of art to be installed at Five Points MARTA station. I'm working with various organizations and individuals around the city to get this project brought to life, to have it brought to reality. And I'm going to be proposing it to the city of Atlanta and also MARTA. And this show afforded me an opportunity to do kind of like a soft preview of the motivating force behind the project. So I came up with the whole idea of doing a time-lapse video of Five Points MARTA station. So I basically went down there guerrilla style with the camera and just set up shop right there in the middle of Five Points MARTA station and shot footage. And I did that for about 15 minutes before the police caught me, and they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm just working on an art project." And they said, "Well, you need permission." So I said, "Well, can I shoot them across the street?" They said, "Sure." This is what I did. And then I got that image from the Atlanta History Center of the Crawford auction house, and worked with a very talented multimedia artist by the name of Christian Wolford, who was my technical support person for the show. And he worked on superimposing that image, doing a ghostly registry of the slave auction house on top of Five Points MARTA station. And then the block was an easy thing because at the core of the proposal for the permanent installation is a series of blocks with feet on top of them that kind of come down this cascade down this step pavilion in one of the courtyards of Five Points MARTA station. So I just did the single block, and then the artist, the incredible singer, Shayla Whitehead, who's astonishing, she and I had lived together previously, and I said, "I got to have you to perform." And I didn't give her a whole lot of instruction. I said, "I just want you to walk through the space as people are looking at work with a very simple white dress. I don't want you to speak to anybody. You are focused on a very clear objective. I want you to ascend the block and begin singing." And she did, and God, did she ever sing and fill the room with this incredible
energy.
Oh, my.
What was she singing?
I told her I wanted her to be Motherless Child, which she did part of that. And then I told her to just let the spirit kind of move her to some other spirituals, whatever she felt. I really wanted to, this to kind of in a way be a collaborative process. So I definitely said I wanted Motherless Child, but after that it was up to her. I think she did one or two other parts of songs. I can't remember exactly which ones they were.
And I can't either. It didn't really matter what was coming out of her mouth. The voice, the resonance was so beautiful of her voice, and of course so moving, the of what we realized she was representing.
Yeah, yeah. She's an incredible talent. And then the other part of it, of course, was me firing the slingshot and this kind of like contrast between that incredible experience of her singing and then this jarring reality taking place at the other end of the room and the kind of tension between the two experiences, which is something I was really interested in as well. So,
go into that. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead if you had something else.
No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
So, yes, in the middle of her singing or at the end of her singing, you came over to your other art piece, mm-hmm. which I believe is entitled Freedom's Price, mm-hmm. and it is a bunch of it's many pictures of African-Americans on the wall, their face, and then you have a slingshot set up in front of each one of them and a water fountain and a spigot, and one saying colored side and the other saying the white side. So explain what you were doing with this.
Well, that was I was really interested in honoring the ancestors, and in particular, those who participated in the Freedom Riders struggle who didn't get all the press, who didn't get all of the public accolades. They just got up every day and they did the work. So they were anonymous in their service, which to me is quite often some of the most difficult service to do when you're not getting the praise and the recognition. You're just operating on faith, belief, conviction. And so I wanted to honor the people that were the more anonymous souls who participated. And these were black and white men and women who just really believed in laying it all out on the line for human dignity and brotherhood and freedom. So I did a series of 11 silkscreen images in sepia tone on raw wood with a kind of like transparency blue background, and then covered them in resin. Resin is a liquid glass that hardens, to solid glass. And I had slingshots on poles set up in front of each one like a firing squad, and then a segregation sign, as you indicated, with a sink and a spigot and a dividing wall indicating whites only and colored only. And as Shayla was singing, I had a working slingshot in my pocket, and I picked up stones from the ground because there's a number of stones that are resting on the ground beneath the portrait. So I picked up 11 and started firing at each portrait, and the shock of the stones hitting a portrait, the sound, because it's a very loud sound in that space, the acoustics.
It is.
Yes, it was really jolting. And then I walked up, I said a prayer, and I uttered the same prayer three times, louder each time, and then I walked up and kissed each portrait. And it was a way of honoring the sacrifice and just kind of paying homage to them. The quote on the wall next to the piece, incidentally, is from Martin Luther King, and it says, "Unearned suffering is redemptive." So this whole idea of sacrificing and suffering for something larger than yourself, and how that has eternal repercussions on the life of the spirit. So there's redemption in that. So mm-hmm. yeah, so that was the idea behind it. Yeah,
a really beautiful piece. You have such a juxtaposition for your art, Masood. This is what I love about your work. It's not only multimedia, but it has pieces in it that make you think and obviously tell history and tell stories, and particularly you're working with the history of the African Americans here in the United States and around the world. But it's a just to see that, as you said, a slingshot on a pole in front of a face is jarring. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? And then when you started actually firing those rocks, it was the whole room lit up and paid attention. And so you really open our souls and open our thoughts to not only what has been, but obviously what our present is and what our future needs to be or could be. And so it's I love your work that way.
Thank you.
There was another piece I want to talk about, and then of course anything else you want to share about this exhibition. I was very intrigued by the letters in the writer's block section, where you have these old typewriters. It was lovely to see all the old typewriters. And then you have these sheets of paper coming out of the typewriters with a story and a person's face on the top of the paper. So it is about that person. Tell us where those stories came from. Are these poems you wrote or stories you wrote, or did you find them in some history? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, they're all people, the selections, there's seven of them, and they were all people that had been significant in my life. It was a way of honoring people who played, some of the people who played a significant part in my life, and in a way kind of working through some of the complex history, the complicated history associated with those relationships. So there was a certain amount of catharsis involved in creating those pieces. So I have a piece to my dad, a piece to my mom, to my great-grandmother, to my sculpture professor when I'm a student in Morehouse, to my college girlfriend who passed away from breast cancer at the age of 26, who else is in there, and to me. There's one about me at 11 years old. And it's just a way of mining my history and understanding something hopefully deeper about my own experience and also the experiences of some of those who have been so significant in my life. One of the things that as I've gotten a little bit older, I've come to understand is that everybody has a journey, everybody has a story. And when we judge people's actions and the things that they do, we have to look at it in the context of where they've been and what they've gone through. Doesn't mean that we dismiss the behavior or say that what they did was justified or right or wrong or what have you, but we have to remember that the scope of how we view one another is limited because we haven't walked in the shoes of another person fully. All we see is based on our limited reaction with that soul. So there's a certain amount of humility that has to come into play, I think, when we assess who another human being is and the choices and decisions that they made. And these pieces were really about, for me, trying to contextualize that through art and arrive at a deeper understanding. The drawings are in pen and ink, very simple, and they're pointillism, which is a method of drawing that the artist Georges Seurat, the French artist, kind of revolutionized. And there's just something, the typewriter is a vehicle to kind of codify or, in a way, institutionalize the dignity of the story to show its kind of importance, its relevance, and its dignity. And then the term writer's block, the sign, of course, is pretty self-explanatory. You've got a line of typewriters, so there's a notion of this being a writer's block. And that phrase offers, operates multivalently as well. But the writer's block is really a block you're not able to write. So you have it kind of like stops you from writing. But then I'm using the term, I'm subverting it, inverting it, writer's block, as in a block of writers.
Yes.
Yeah.
You even have it as a street sign, so it's, again, this multifaceted meaning of the different media components from your art is really fabulous. I love it, because you're right, it has all this. It makes me smile when I think about, okay, you've got the typewriter, and yes, you've got the block of people, and then, of course, the way we think of, as you just said, writer's block, so many different layers.
It's one other thing I'd like to say. All the poems are mine. I mean, I compose those myself, the narratives that are on the page, and that really comes from, I'll tell you, Gail, growing up and traveling, being on the train for like 3.5 hours, traveling from Far Rockaway, Queens to get to my high school in New Jersey. It was the only arts high school that would accept me outside of the district. So I had all that time, and we're talking the late 80s, and I had all that time. This is before iPads, iPhones. you had a Walkman, you had a book, or you went to sleep. I did all three, but I spent a lot of time reading, and I developed a love for language and for writing that way. And it's just interesting how those experiences, we never know how they're going to play themselves out later in life. And things that we think are maybe at a certain time might be an inconvenience or a discomfort become blessings later on because you see how they have played into your present life. So, yeah.
Well, you certainly do mine your history for your art. But tell us, okay, so I want to explore this for just a moment. Tell us a bit about that travel from your high school. You had to go, you said 3.5 hours? Did I hear you wrong?
3.5 hours. Yeah, no, you're right. About three and a half hours. I mean, on a bad day, it was 3.5. Yeah, on a train. Yeah.
On a train to get to your high school.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I would get up at 5 in the morning. I would get up at 5 in the morning every morning. I initially was supposed to go to LaGuardia High School of the Arts in New York City, but they wouldn't even look at my portfolio because I lived outside of the district. They were very strict about only accepting students inside of the district. So my mother, who was not one to take no for an answer, kept looking around for an art school to accept me. And then she found Arts High School in Newark, which is really the oldest arts high school in the entire United States. And they accepted me, and it's just what I did for about 4 or 5 months before we moved to Newark. I would get up every morning at 5, take a bus from Far Rockaway. Far Rockaway is right on the ocean, for people that don't know. And I would take the bus to the train station. I would take the train into Manhattan, and then I would switch trains, and then I would take the I think it was the E train that I took all the way downtown to the World Trade Center station. I would get off there, transfer to the PATH train. I would take the PATH train over to Newark, New Jersey, to Penn Station. I would get out of Penn Station and take the bus up the hill to school, walk over 2 blocks, and I was at school.
And how old were you at this time?
Oh, 16, 17, yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that art school.
Oh, man. Well, art high school was a magical place. I went to 4 different high schools. When my parents got divorced, I was traveling back and forth between the two of them. I wound up going to 3 different arts high schools. The first was the New Orleans Center of Creative Arts in New Orleans, obviously. I also went to the Dallas High School of the Arts, which was an extraordinary place. And then the Newark School of the Arts, Arts High School in Newark, New Jersey. And it's a wonderful place. I mean, it's always really talented kids. It was 99% African-American and Latino. And Newark is, for many people who don't know, who haven't been there, Newark is a pretty impoverished part of the country historically. Especially in the 80s, there was still the imprint of the riots from the 60s in the city, burnt out buildings, gutted buildings, high crime. But there were really some wonderful people in the city, and in particular at that high school. I think a lot of the students suffered from low expectations. They didn't believe that they could accomplish things that they had the wherewithal and the talent to do. But it's difficult to dream big when you come from some of these environments. And I know for me, that was one of the big challenges for me, is moving forward and beyond that experience, thinking that I could do what some people thought I could do. It was just hard to see the possibility of that when you're surrounded by some really extreme and adverse circumstances. But nonetheless, some really talented people. Xavion Glover, the world-famous tap dancer, came out of that school. Whitney Houston came out of that school. Mir Baraka, the famous poet, his son went to that school. He's now the mayor of Newark. So some really amazing, talented people came out of that program, and I'm fortunate to have gone there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Who was one of your main mentors of that school or that time for you?
Oh, let's see. Well, there was Mrs. Caldwell, who was my art teacher, who went on to become principal eventually. She was extraordinary, combined exacting standards with a really deep reservoir of love. She always felt like she was calling you to something higher out of love and belief in you. There was Mr. Gross, who a lot of people were very afraid of, who could be very cantankerous, but he believed in his students and had very exacting standards as well, and was very strict. But it was because he believed that we could do great things. Those are some of the people that really stand out for me. And there were others, but it's not just them who really kind of put their arms around me and kind of gave me a notion that, you might be able to accomplish more than what you think you can. So, yeah,
wow.
Some of those people. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. So, Masoud, mm-hmm. we're getting close to the end of our time together. And what final words of wisdom for our listeners would you like to share?
I would say, I would quote Muhammad Ali's poem, which became the, after he uttered it at Harvard, at a lecture at Harvard, was officially recognized as the shortest poem in the English language, and it was Me, We. And what I've learned in my life is that nobody can do this alone, and that we need each other as a community of beings on this planet in order to accomplish the things that we want to accomplish. And you get as you give. Those two are interdependent, and you know, you can't be successful if your hand is closed. And one of the most beautiful things for me, realizations, is that the gesture for giving and receiving is exactly the same. It's an open hand.
Yes, it is. Interesting. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. There is great resonance of your work here in Georgia, in Atlanta. And I know that the Atlanta community really supports you, and that this is a great place for you to be showcasing your art. So again, let's invite people to come to the MoCA Georgia at 75 Bennett Street, I believe, in Atlanta, and
yes.
Your exhibition is The Poetics of the Disembodied, and it's playing through September 10th, 2016. After that, where are you going to be? Where can people find you? Obviously, your website is Masud, Masud-Olufani, Olufani, .squarespace.com. And what are your plans afterwards?
I have a, because I don't like to, because for some reason I seem to be wired to want to do things difficultly, I have a show that opens up in Savannah in August the 16th. So I'm present and getting ready for that. That'll be at the SCAD Museum of Fine Art in downtown Savannah. And then I have a show that opens up at the Atlanta Airport, a group show, which will be opening up actually in early August. So I'm getting ready for that. So
where is that again? That one?
That'll be at That won't be at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport.
At the airport.
At the internet.
Okay.
Yeah, be at the airport.
Wow.
And I'm shooting a film in the fall. And I'll be performing as an actor, doing a piece, a one-man play called Dave Drake at the Decatur Book Festival in September. So, you know, busy, but it's a
good
Excellent.
Busy. And, you
yeah.
are a busy man. Well, thank you, Masud, for being on the Peace Brain Show, and I know all of your work definitely contributes to peace on the planet. Thank you very much. You have a beautiful day.
You too. We'll talk
soon. Yes, we will. So now is the part of the show where we'll tune into a Peace Brain meditation, and I just invite all of you to sit back and take a breath. Wow. What beautiful, again, I want to use the word multifaceted, parts of ourselves that art brings out and parts of our history that we've talked about today. And I encourage you, wherever you are in the world, that you go visit your art museums and your local artists and allow yourself to open up. So with this, let's go into the Peace Brain meditation where I invite you to take a breath. And then ground yourself. And what that is, we've done this in previous shows as well, is basically giving yourself an energetic connection from the base of your spine, that last vertebrae, down to the center of the planet. And I like to envision a tree trunk, for example, or maybe a waterfall coming out of the base of my spine and going down into Mother Earth, really anchoring into her core, her iron crystal core. And again, take a breath and let all of the day's energy just flow down that grounding cord and into Mother Earth to be recycled into fresh, new energy. This is exactly the same as that third prong on the electrical outlet, that grounding wire, so that when surges of energy come your way, you don't get burned out. You actually just allow it to flow back into Mother Earth and be recycled. So ground yourself. And be present. It brings one into the present moment. And think about the art that you've seen in your life. Think about how it has inspired you and opened up your creative resources. Remember perhaps your time to the first time to an art museum, or that you received paper and crayons and were able to express yourself coloring outside the lines and using your imagination. Allow yourself to be that little child again, to really feel the joy and the happiness of the creativity, no one's opinions and judgments on you, just free-flowing creativity and art that comes out of your soul, whether it be with crayons and paper, or with your voice and song, or perhaps reciting a poem, or creating some dramatic work of art. You are multifaceted as well, and you have great gifts to give to the world. We all have come under those judgments and those oppressions, which Massoud's art is so beautiful at explaining and showing how we each have to work and strive to shed those skins of oppression and judgment in order to shine our own light. And so perhaps now we'll learn a tool to shed some of those oppressions. So think of a judgment or a time when you did feel oppressed. And I invite you to put up a rose flower in front of you. A rose is a very sacred flower, a very sacred vibration, and is in most, if not all, sacred works around the planet. And I invite you to make this rose be a sticky rose or a magnetic rose, and assign that oppression or that judgment that you may have had in you, in your being since you were a little child. It may be a word that someone said to you, or an action that someone took and you took against you. But allow that rose, in its great beauty, to draw off that energy of that oppression, to draw off the energy of that judgment. And you can assign a color, if you choose, to that event, and allow the color to flow into the rose, the energy of that to flow into the rose. It is taking this up and magnetizing it away from your body, away from your soul, and out of your space. It does not mean that the memory goes away. What it means is the charge, the emotional charge on that event is neutralized. So allow the rose to collect up that energy, that emotions. And then once it has done so, because energy is instant, you can put a firecracker under it and blow it up into these beautiful sparkles of light, giving that energy back to the universe, back to the Creator, to be used again as neutral, new energy for some other creation, clearing your space of that energy, of that oppression or judgment. And I invite you to now create a beautiful gold sun above your head, a golden ball of light. This is your energy. This is your beautiful self. And call back where you may have left yourself in some other event, in the grocery store, in a conversation. Call back your energy into this golden ball of light so that you can be complete and whole. And then I invite you to allow this golden light to flow down into your body, from your head to your feet, like honey or molasses, into every cell of your body, filling up yourself with your beautiful divine light of who you are. you're filling up all the spaces where you took out that judgment and oppression. And allowing yourself to be whole, to be the great artist of your own life, and to shine your gifts and your light out into the world. Own your divinity and your brightness. Own your place in creating this world of peace, prosperity, and power for all peoples. So take a breath and bring yourself back to the present. Perhaps you have a smile on your face. You are beautiful when you shine your light and when you allow your artistic creativity to shine through as well. We need your art. We need your joy. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to the Peace Brain Show today. And my guest, Masoud Alafani, Renaissance artist. And so now I invite you all to please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your mark on the World Peace Trails map. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Alchemy of Peace coaching sessions, her Peace Master plans for your business or organization, and her upcoming book, Peace Brain 101. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 2 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern for the Peace Brain Show and your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.